Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, live from Las Vegas, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. You know, good news for you. I'm a little bit feisty today, and I'm mad at whiners. But for once, you're not the one doing the whining, so you're off the hook.
Okay.
Vegas Summer League has just gotten bigger and better than ever. Arguably, maybe even too big for its own good at this point, Andrew. I mean, they had like 10 Papa Shot games set up on the concourse. All 30 teams are here. The scrums to, you know, capture a glimpse of Kevin Knox are like 8 people deep in, you know, semicircles after these scrimmage games, right?
Yeah.
I'm hearing an awful lot of media members who don't want to be here, Andrew. And on behalf of the Las Vegas Summer League diehards, this is my 10th Summer League, on behalf of the hardworking organizers, people like Joanna Shapiro, Michael Pirelli at the NBA League office, who are putting in like 18-hour days because they have 5 sets of games this year instead of just 4 sets of games. So basically, the basketball starts at 12 and doesn't end until almost, you know, 11 p.m. at night. On behalf of them, I would like to say, if you don't want to be in the gym, if you don't want to be in Las Vegas, we don't want you here. Get out. Take your bad attitude and clear out so I can watch Wendell Carter and Mo Bamba and DeAndre Ayton and Jaren Jackson Jr. and the rest of these guys do their thing. No more negativity, Andrew.
Okay, well, let me tell you something, Ben. I am on the other side of that spectrum. However, I'm not in Vegas. For the first time in like 6 or 7 years, I decided not to go to Summer League precisely because I anticipated my grumpiness before I got out there and just said, you know what? This is not the year for me to make that move. It's been a long basketball season. And for me, whenever I get out to Vegas, it is very cool. And if you haven't done it, you should try it. But if you're a fan going, or if you're a media member going, be prepared to kind of look around in a haze and be like, is this really what my life has come to? Because the basketball itself is incredibly sloppy. And then also you're in like 110 degree July heat. And for me, I always have this kind of come to Jesus moment where I'm like, oh my God, I haven't eaten anything but hot dogs for the last 16 hours. Like, I have no idea how long I've been in this gym. I don't recognize a single player on the court. And I have no idea what the hell is happening. And that's just kind of part of the process with Summer League. It's great for a lot of different reasons, but it does get very real. It's not for the faint of heart, which I think is what you're trying to say.
No, you've brilliantly captured the mood. I mean, it has been 110. It has been the 6th layer of hell in terms of the weather. The games are out of control. The highlight of my day yesterday was watching Bobby Portis in a Dennis Rodman jersey scroll through his phone looking at pictures of Bobby Portis in a Dennis Rodman jersey. That's like,
that's, you know, amazing.
That's what we've got going on here in Vegas.
Can I give you one take on that Bobby Portis moment?
You can, but just real quick. It's supposed to hurt. Vegas Summer League is not supposed to be fun. We're here to enjoy, you know, the masochism. That's what it's all about.
Okay, yeah. And look, there's nothing that you enjoy more than a little masochism. A couple weeks, I don't mean to take this podcast to a weird place, but no, you are the type of dude that is ready to kind of like hunker down for 3 weeks and just go all in on a bunch of meaningless basketball. It's become a trademark of yours at this point.
Well, people love to say it's meaningless. I would actually push back on that too. I'm not going to say it's beautiful or it's pretty, but seeing these guys up close and personal, you learn a lot about them, Andrew. I'm already starting to change some of my opinions from the draft process. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, a guy like Wendell Carter, Jaren Jackson Jr., and that was one that kind of made me scratch my head. You know, what are they thinking passing on both Trey and Luka? I mean, some of these guys have had some really nice moments here, and I think it's good for franchises that need them. I'm like, if I'm a Bulls fan, I would really care about Summer League. If I was a Grizzlies fan, I would be, you know, pretty excited
for
about
sure.
what I'd seen from Jaren Jackson Jr., given that 2 weeks ago, Andrew, it was like, well, what's the point here? Now we have to trade Mark, and we didn't get Luka. We're probably going to look like morons. Like, you know, I think that there is, you know, some level of, you know, hope being added to the equation for some of these bad teams. And for me, I'm just trying to, you know, ride that wave. I'm trying to get in on some secondhand hope.
Okay, I hear you. Yes, there's no question that for like 6 to 10 teams each summer, Summer League actually does matter, because the players at the center of it really kind of control the next 5 years of your franchise's destiny. That is not necessarily true with like the Washington Wizards, who are running out Troy Brown and Thomas Bryant and Issoufou Sanron. Like, so it's not as important for a lot of the teams out there. However, let's start there with the Bulls. My Bobby Portis take was going to be simply that he is not good enough to wear a Dennis Rodman jersey, as if he's kind of like the next generation of Rodman. I think somebody should have stepped in and been like, look, you're as crazy and reckless and unreliable as Rodman, but you're like 5% as good. So take that jersey off right now. I wish that had happened on the baseline in Vegas.
Yeah, and, you know, this is a conspiracy theory here for you, but I actually think the jersey was a plant. I've been noticing a lot of really impressive high-end throwback jerseys on guys who are, you know, sitting courtside and getting a lot of TV time. You might have seen Donovan Mitchell wearing a Karl Malone jersey, which, Andrew, I love Utah. I mean, you know me. I rank my five favorite national parks in Utah off the top of my head for fun. You would never catch me dead in a Karl Malone jersey in public under any circumstances. And yeah, Donovan Mitchell is out there with that. I think there must be some sort of an agreement here to get these guys in the jerseys. I don't think they're all individually buying these and just happening to show up at the games in them.
Well, good. All right. We're going to bounce around Summer League for the first half of this podcast. We're going to try to keep it to a tight 60 minutes today. And we may as well just start with the Bulls here. Got a question from Dakota, who says, hey guys, I'm a Bulls fan, and my question for you is very simple. What is Wendell Carter's ceiling? Ben, I know you've been at Summer League watching him. What are your thoughts so far? Hit me.
Well, my first Bulls thought is this. It was funny that Zach LaVine, after signing his $78 million contract, got to sit in sort of like the prestige courtside seats on the sideline, whereas Bobby Portis, Denzel Valentine, and Cameron Payne were sitting in the less prestige seats along the baseline. And obviously, Gar Forman's there and Fred Hoiberg's there. And it was almost sort of like, okay, you know, guys who are actually going to be on our team for the next few years, they get to sit in this end. And the guys who we might trade during this Summer League game are going to be over here in this little holding pen of of like pseudo Bulls that we don't know about. In terms of Wendell Carter, so polished, so smart, wise beyond his years, and you could just tell he's from a basketball family. I think both his parents played. It shows.
Yep.
He doesn't need to do a lot of dribbling to get to good spots on the court, effortlessly moving around the perimeter, both defensively and offensively. He's had tons and tons of block shots. When you look at him physically, you know, his length doesn't necessarily like blow you away, but his timing and instincts are really good, and so he's just been racking up block shots left and right. And I think, you know, in terms of a guy who's willing to do the little things in Summer League, that's hard to find, you know, for big guys. I mean, most of the big guys are, you know, kind of doofuses, you know, jogging around, you know, trying three-pointers, not really, you know, entertaining the energy level necessary to switch and recover and, you know, provide help side defense. And this guy is doing all of those things. I think, you know, kind of coming away from the draft, we had had that conversation, like, is Carter better right now than Bagley, or where does that stand?
Right.
And like, you know, does Bagley have the higher ceiling? Like, to me, there's not really a comparison. I mean, Carter has been really, really impressive. Bagley, it's kind of been more hit or miss. I just think if you're a Bulls fan, you've got to be delighted with the value at that pick, given that, you know, they didn't really do the tank quite right. So they should have been drafting in the top three, but they screwed it up.
Yeah.
But like, to come away with Carter from that and have a pairing with Markkanen where you have definitely a guy who's going to be a plus defender to cover up for Markkanen, I like that base a lot.
Yeah, well, and I think the Wendell Carter experience through the first couple days of Summer League dovetails nicely with how I've experienced a lot of these games. And granted, most of what I'm seeing is highlights, and I'm hearing things from other people who are out there. However, a lot of the rookie class looks better than I would have expected. And I think as the draft hit in late June, a lot of these guys were kind of underwhelming by the time we actually got to draft day. And now we're seeing this draft class, like, almost everybody looks pretty impressive thus far. Focused on Wendell Carter here for a second. I mean, his ceiling is Al Horford, and that's what people were talking about like a month before the draft, and it all kind of looked ridiculous. And we got some heat after I kind of came out on draft night and questioned the defensive fit in Chicago, and people said, well, Wendell Carter Jr.'s defensive metrics at Duke were excellent. And I guess that, I mean, certainly that seems to be true, but anytime you watched him play, like, he didn't really move laterally very well, and Duke was playing a 2-3 zone in part, apparently, because they were worried about Wendell Carter and Marvin Bagley on defense. But thus far, the way he's moving defensively has got to be, like, the biggest surprise for Bulls fans and for basically all draft nerds everywhere. And also, like, the biggest reason to get really excited about the future, because we knew he was going to be super skilled and really smart offensively. And in that respect, he's a perfect guy to pair with Lauri Markkanen. But now adding in the defense and that Chicago future is starting to get really interesting, which is very Bulls falling ass backwards into like the second or third best player in the draft and suddenly having an awesome future is classic Gar Foreman and John Paxson. So here we go.
That's why we call Gar Big Head, Andrew. I mean, that's a deep cut throwback for the Open Floor Globe members who remember that one from a year ago. But he just finds a way to stumble into something good every once in a while.
It's great.
The thing I'd say about Wendell Carter, just sort of the last thing, his family has been taking some shots, subtle and not so subtle.
I love it.
at Coach K and Duke and how he was used and everything else. And then this kid was a big, big-time high school player coming out of Georgia. Yeah. I think he also might be one of these guys who is just a better fit in an NBA environment, right? And I think what you're mentioning about his, you know, quickness laterally and all of that, that's going to be tested on a much different level when he gets to, like, NBA games, right? But if you're able to get by well or really succeed on the summer league level, that is – clearly, you know, it's obviously a positive, especially for a player as young as him.
Yeah, absolutely. And for context, for anyone who doesn't follow high school recruiting, what happened was that Wendell Carter committed to Duke and was going to be like the guy at Duke. And he actually was deciding between Duke and Harvard late in the process and went to Duke. And so he was like a top 10 recruit, et cetera, et cetera. And then what happened is that Marvin Bagley reclassified and Duke went and got him. And so Wendell Carter was sort of marginalized next to Bagley, and they were able to make it work more often than not. And Wendell Carter was hurt a little bit during the season, but certainly the case for buying in on him around the draft was that, like, he was going to look much better on his own in an NBA setting, and that has proven true so far. So,
can I tell you, okay, I lied. I had one more thing I wanted to say about Wendell Carter. The key anecdote people always mention about him, like, his high school coach always tells this story of how, like, after they would win games, he was easily the best player on the team. Uh-huh. But he was, like, kind of raised by his parents to, you know, sort of just by the book, right? So he would, like, go through the team bus and, like, pick up all the trash after they won the state championship and, like, personally clean the bus.
That is when,
and, like,
he
has all this mantra of, like, you know, leave places better than you found them. I mean, that sounds an awful lot like take nothing but pictures, leave nothing but footprints, which is, of course, my national park creed. So I got to say, this guy, Ranger Perfect. Wendell, is right up my alley. I love this guy.
Oh, I love it. Well, sticking with the Bulls, and we'll hit a couple more summer league standouts in a second, but we should talk about the LaVine deal here for a minute. What do you think? Because let me tell you something. I had Zach LaVine on my fantasy team for the final few months of the season. RIP Team Sharp. It wasn't a great year for us, in part because we were relying heavily on Zach LaVine. But I watched a lot of Bulls games and was not very impressed. Are you more bullish on this deal for the Bulls?
Well, I actually just got off the radio with two hosts in Chicago. I kid you not, their names were Danny and Dan, which just is like right out of Central Casting, you know, their afternoon drive time show. And they wanted to just essentially hear me rant about the Zach LaVine deal because I gave it a D+ in my grade.
Okay.
And Danny and Dan were not totally thrilled with what the Bulls have done here. I think the way I phrased it, you're signing him through gritted teeth. If you lose him, you're taking a big step back. You're already kind of pot committed after the Jimmy Butler trade to like retain those guys as core pieces. And you don't have any scoring. Your offense was atrocious last year. Lowry's not going to be able to be a one-man guy. You've got to have something resembling a lead playmaker in the backcourt.
Yeah.
But, man, you really don't want to pay this guy nearly $20 million a year. I think we should give a lot of credit to Zach LaVine's agent for buttering Vlade up over the last 12 months, because it only takes one sucker, right, in restricted free agency. You've got to convince one team to buy into your guy. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. You know, I was writing that story on Yusuf Nurkic last fall. I mean, they never really found that other team, Andrew. Like, you know, he had a great season, career year in Portland. You know, he's hoping to cash in this big-time contract. He winds up getting, you know, 4 for $48. And, you know, that's fine, but it's not like this, you know, smash success because there wasn't a lot of outside interest in him. You look at LaVine with his red flags, play zero defense, one-dimensional offensively, coming off an ACL, hasn't made major strides during his NBA career over his four seasons.
Yeah.
To be able to pull a $78 million offer out of Vlade Divac's pocket is incredible work by his agent. And
well,
I think for Chicago, they lose Russian roulette, you know, bang, like they lost.
Yeah, no question. And that's kind of the way it goes with restricted free agency sometimes. But I would say this, I should clarify my thoughts because I think that I don't mind the Zach LaVine deal, even for Chicago, because look, they're not going to be contending for the next couple of years. And like, the weaknesses in LaVine's game won't necessarily matter until they get to like the middle of the playoffs. And I think he can still help them over the next few years. I think my issue, though, is I don't necessarily love Zach LaVine. And for people who have been longtime Open Floor listeners, I did love Zach LaVine a couple years ago. He was like the consummate bucket getter. But as you said, he just doesn't play any defense, like zero. It's kind of incredible how easily guys penetrate whenever he's guarding them. And then also is like a high volume scorer, but not efficient at all. And it will go like 8 for 25 on a regular basis. And that's not a great combination. So yeah, I liked
the way
it more.
I put it,
what I would say is I like it more as a crazy gamble for a Kings team that doesn't have a lot of options than I like it for a Bulls team that, again, has fallen ass backwards into like an awesome front line for the next 10 years. And I'm now invested in the success of the Bulls. And part of that is the first couple days of Wendell Carter Jr. And so adding Zach LaVine to that mix at $20 million a year, like he'll be movable if they really want to. But he's going to have to get a lot better for him to kind of be someone that Bulls fans are actually excited about.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really like it for Chicago. I mean, you have to do it, but boy, it's painful.
Yeah,
you got to do
rough.
It through gritted
it's
teeth.
It's rough. And like,
I didn't like it for Sacramento. I think the only winners here are LaVine, his agent, and the Gucci salesman in Chicago, who are going to be getting, you know, a lot of repeat business from Zach. But I think the way to put it is this: he's so bad defensively that to be worth $20 million basically per year,
yeah,
he would have to be like a top five player at his position offensively. When you look, does he play make for his teammates? No. Is he going to let Lowry Markkanen and Wendell Carter Jr. you know, cut with their hands and be wide open and just completely miss them? Yes, he is. He's not going to be able to really set those guys up. Can he run an offense? No, he failed miserably when he was asked to do that in Minnesota. His most efficient offensive season came when he played with Karl Anthony Towns and Andrew Wiggins, where he's playing more of a complementary role. He's not going to be in that complimentary role in Chicago because now he's got the money and he's going to have the ball in his hands a lot. And so I think that that's going to lead to a little bit, you know, too much self-confidence, self-trust, self-belief. That's not going to be necessarily helpful to their offense. And my last thing here real quick, his best offensive seasons have not translated to team success. I mean, basically all the offenses he's been on have not been very good, and the teams don't really perform that much different when he's on the court or off the court when it comes to the offense. So that's a problem. He has a lot to prove here over these next couple of years, and it's not just about his health. It's about evolving the overall value of his game, and he's had 4 years to show progress. I just haven't seen very much progress. He's kind of the same guy he was when he came into the NBA.
Yeah, that would be my biggest concern, that last point about whether he actually impacts the game at all, even when he's playing well. And that's a real question mark. And the one silver lining I would add, though, is that you talk about Minnesota. I would rather be paying Zach LaVine 4 for $80 than whatever Minnesota is currently paying Andrew Wiggins. I think that ultimately the Bulls are getting a better deal than that, at least. And Zach LaVine is able to kind of to knock down threes off the bounce, which is a really valuable skill if he can fix the other holes in his game, of which there are many. But I think there's at least something to work with there.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd still rather have Wiggins.
Really?
You're getting to the free throw line more often. I don't think he's nearly as bad of a defender as LaVine is. I mean, not only does LaVine have awareness issues defensively and kind of competitiveness issues defensively, but I also think there's just a lack of physicality on that end. Like, you just don't feel him, you know? Like, he's a breeze. Like, you know, you walk into a room, he's the breeze. Like, you just get by him, no problem. And I think Wiggins, he is definitely under more of a microscope. He gets nitpicked more because he was a number one pick and because his contract is so big.
Yeah.
But I think both in terms of trade value and just guys I would want on my team, I would take Wiggins over LaVine.
Respective deals?
Even on their respective deals, yes.
All right, so you are down on Zach LaVine. All right, well, hey, Chicago, you still have Wendell Carter. It's all good. Moving on to the rest of Summer League. Brandon in LA had this question. He said, I've been pretty impressed with Marvin Bagley in Summer League, but the guy who keeps jumping off the screen during Kings games is Harry Giles. He knocked down a three. He's running the floor the way he used to. Are you guys as excited as I am about Giles? I will answer in the limited clips that I've seen from Giles thus far. He looks awesome, and I am actually really, really excited. And he's another guy who was kind of like Michael Porter Jr. a year ago. And, you know, that was the benefit of the Kings deal on draft night. They got crushed for trading. I think it was from 10 to 15 and 20. They traded with the Blazers and picked up an extra pick and took a flyer on Giles. But I like what I've seen thus far, and he's someone I'm definitely rooting for. And from a like theoretical standpoint, he has kind of the full package. So what have you seen in person?
Yeah, I saw one game and Sacramento got smoked off the court. And like, I mean, not to pile on Vlade again, but I will. You know, he called his team a super team, just young. Like, if that was true, they should be really good in Summer League.
Running shit, I swear, in Vegas.
And these guys just get smoked every time I watch them. And I think De'Aaron Fox might actually came back for them the other night. I didn't get to see that game, but I was getting some messages from people who were pretty excited about how the Kings looked. So, you know, maybe that explains Brandon's question. Giles, it's great to see him on the court, first of all. I think if he's able to come back and be like a major rotation guy for them and just get his career back on track after the volume of time he spent away. I mean, it's almost like Jabari Parker level of disappearing act. You know what I mean? Like, just away from the court for such an extended stretch. It will be a really, really amazing story. And, you know, it almost makes you want like the NBA to come back with that NBA comeback player of the year thing that they had for a while. because he would certainly be a candidate. He's interesting. He's not exactly what I thought he was going to be, you know, coming out of high school. Obviously, he has to kind of play up positions maybe more than I expected.
Yeah.
At least in the summer league level, but active, confident, smooth. I mean, I didn't see a ton of, you know, like you would expect after not seeing a guy for that long after a major injury, like you'd expect hesitancy or, you know, like passivity. And I didn't really see that from him. And so I guess I'd like to see more before I render judgment. But I think just the fact he's out there on the court is a big win.
Yeah, it does make you wonder how much they knew about Giles's progress, because, like, again, if you're thinking about that Kings roster in theory, if Harry Giles is going to be a player you can kind of count on, which we shouldn't read too much into, like, two or three summer league games, but still, I don't know why you choose Bagley over Doncic on draft night. And that is going to be one, and it's not totally fair to put that on Bagley, because he's going to have to, like, live down that what if over the next couple years, and it's kind of a raw deal for him. But what the hell were they thinking? It remains a valid question.
Idea.
So
I have no idea. And look, Doncic hasn't even played here yet, and you could argue he's had a better summer league than both Ayton and Bagley. So
yeah. Well, what have you seen from Ayton thus far?
So the first game, they just, like, double teamed him hard constantly, and they weren't ready for it. I mean, the Suns summer league roster, you know, much like their big roster in recent years, is really lacking in, you know, quality playmakers and kind of offense initiators. And so it's been this sort of game of, like, spend 15 seconds just trying to pass the ball to Ayton to see if he can even get it. Once he gets it, the hard double comes, and then he just, like, quickly lasers a pass out to the perimeter and someone bricks a three-pointer. I mean, I'm being a little bit pessimistic in how I'm describing it, but they've had a lot of issues with their offensive fluidity. Defensively, I was hoping for more. I think there's times where I feel like he should be able to come over and help contest shots, and he's just not there. So he's either out of position or late reacting. He's had, you know, some fairly good nights in terms of, you know, impact on the glass. And he's had a couple of highlight plays, but it hasn't been one of those, you know, transformative type summers, like, you know, a Blake Griffin type summer or anything like that. I mean, he's not like he's another guy on the court. I mean, clearly, like, physically, he looms over everybody, and, like, you know, side by side with Bagley, it was like, you know, one guy looked like a man and the other looked like a teenager, right? But I guess I was sort of prepared to maybe eat some crow, because I've been pretty anti Ayton kind of coming in, you know, to this whole thing. And so I was worried he was going to come out here and put up 20 tens every night.
Yeah.
And that hasn't happened. So I'm feeling pretty good about it. You know, I think I'd like to see Doncic play just one game out here, and, you know, maybe he's running out of time already, but I feel like if he had one good night, everybody would be ready to say, you know, everybody screwed up by passing on him.
Yeah, it's kind of a chaotic atmosphere to really take over games, and it's hard to read what matters. Like, Donovan Mitchell was dominant last summer, and obviously that was kind of a harbinger of what we would see this season. But, like, Lonzo looked a lot more effective in summer league than he did through most of the regular season. And so I just am wary of putting too much stock in any of this.
Well, I think the takeaway about Ayton that I think does matter, he's very dependent upon being set up for his offense, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can go ahead and try to do the pick and pop thing. If I'm an NBA team, I'm giving him the mid-range shot. Go ahead. You're not going to beat us with your mid-range shot. You're not that good of a mid-range shooter. And then around the basket, I think personnel-wise for Phoenix, they're going to need to try to spread out as much as possible so they can take advantage of his physical tools and his sort of, like, over-the-top, you know, like, alley-oop finish type stuff, like, you know, the DeAndre Jordan style.
Yeah.
Because he could be one of these guys who's going to get crowded out of a game if the floor really isn't spread and opened up wide. And I think, actually, you know, in hindsight, the Trevor Ariza move, I think it benefits Devin Booker, because now Ariza can take all the important defensive responsibilities. But I also think Ariza's floor spacing is going to have a direct impact on what Ayton's able to do offensively, because they just have to have somebody who can stick those shots. And otherwise, you're just going to kind of be squandering Ayton until you figure out the right kind of lineups you can play around him.
Yeah, I actually like that Ariza move for them. I think they're at a point where it makes sense to bring in like credible NBA guys to kind of accelerate things a little bit. I know in DC, it made a difference, and the Wizards were clowned for this when they actually made the move, but they went and got Emeka Okafor and Marcin Gortat to kind of like give the younger Wizards a chance to compete, Bradley Beal and John Wall, namely. And those guys really helped. And I think Ariza can kind of be that presence in Phoenix a little bit. I mean, obviously the Suns are pretty screwed out in the West, but and are not going to make a playoff run. But like, I think they were trying to see if Jared Dudley could be that guy a couple years ago, and he wasn't good enough to actually help on the court. And when teams go out and get veterans, oftentimes they are like 10th men or 11th men or like KG in year 20. And those guys, their voice is not as persuasive as a player who's actually playing 30 or 35 minutes a game. And Ariza can still do that.
Yeah, without dominating the ball and, you know, kind of letting Booker and Ayton run wild and just be, you know, that complimentary option. I mean, I think, you know, Ayton does have a pretty good understanding of where players should be. You know, like, you could really see a situation where he has a surprisingly high assist total as he gets older when defenses collapse on him, because you know, he is a very willing and, you know, kind of unselfish passer out to the perimeter. You know, like, for example, when he's getting doubled, he's not trying to power through two guys, take low percentage shots and, you know, do too much, which I think would be a very natural response for a lot of number one picks who are sort of feeling the pressure to like perform it with everybody watching them and all that kind of stuff. He kind of goes the other way with it. And I think that is a positive sign. I can absolutely see him being, you know, that type of offensive player where, you know, his gravity around the basket makes life easier for role players, and his willingness to trust those guys with the pass, you know, winds up really helping a team's offensive efficiency. And Phoenix needs it. I mean, they really haven't had that impressive of offenses here in recent years, and I think it's going to show when he's out there on the court.
Well, Ben, speaking of aging Houston wings and moving on from our Suns, we should talk about Devin Booker's extension at some point, but moving on for now, Luke Mbamute is going to the Clippers, which is perplexing to me for a couple of reasons. This is live breaking news on the podcast. It won't be live for people who are listening to it. But on the one hand, I don't know how you let him get away if you're the Rockets. And on the other hand, I really don't understand why the Clippers aren't taking this year to try and tank, and why they would want a guy like Mbamute. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like he made a bad pick. Like, what's he doing? Like, his skills make a lot of sense in a Houston or in a Golden State. Where's LA going? I mean, obviously he played with the Clippers earlier. He knows Doc. Doc really liked him. You know, Doc was always campaigning for him for like all defensive first team, you know, or like, you know, trying to throw him into the defensive player of the year conversation.
Yeah.
Doc is incredibly skilled at, you know, trying to get storylines going that don't catch on. He has a real knack for that, you know. I just think, like, if you're Mbamute, you should have stayed in Houston, or you should have hung out in the arms race. I mean, the Lakers, the Warriors, there's better spots.
I would love to see Mbamute go to Philly and reunite with Joel Embiid, who he discovered in Cameroon like 10 years ago. I mean, like, there are a lot of fits for him that would have been really cool. I'd love to see him in Portland. I mean, I don't know what the specifics of the deal are. They haven't been reported yet, but like, it's just kind of a bummer for both sides, because Houston now, they lose Mbamute, they lost Ariza, they're seriously considering adding Carmelo after 12 months of us looking at that team and being like, man, they really dodged a bullet not signing Carmelo or not trading for Carmelo Anthony. But it looks like that's the plan, and I don't really get it. I mean, Carmelo, I'm not as down on him as maybe the rest of the world is. I'd like to see him go to Miami and try to rehab his career. But he just, the one thing you can't really talk yourself into with Carmelo at this point is him swinging a Warriors matchup. Like that's the worst possible fit for him, and it looks like that's where things are headed for him in the Rockets.
Yeah, I mean, Hoodie Mello is going to get embarrassed if he goes to Houston.
It's
going to
be brutal, man. And that's a team that literally all that matters to them is how they match up with the Warriors. And he's not a good matchup for that team.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I'd rather have Mbamute than Mello if I'm Houston.
Yeah.
So I think that's weird. I mean, I don't know if you saw this, but the little tagline that Chris Paul and the Rockets were putting out there after Paul signed his deal was, "Let's run it back," right? Like, we're gonna go and kind of get over the hump after getting so close to Houston. And actually, this is pretty funny. Following Houston's win over Golden State at Summer League, Daryl Morey went up to Bob Myers and he goes, "Now it's 4-4." And Bob Myers is just like cracking
That's
up. It's
awesome.
Like, as if like the Summer League was game 8, you know?
You know what? But, credit to Daryl Morey. He does have a sense of humor about all of this stuff. I like that about him.
No, it was a really funny joke. I mean, I was laughing out loud, and I just told it on the podcast, you know, blatantly ripping it off. But I think we can't say they're running it back, Andrew, because Mbamute's out, Ariza took the cash out. I mean, I think to me the story of this, you know, season followed by this summer for Houston is that there's a shelf life on how long you can keep role players happy and content.
Yeah.
In marginalized situations, right? Like, of course Chris Paul wants to run it back. He's going to get paid $40 million a year. Of course James Harden wants to run it back. He's getting paid max money, and he just won the MVP, and Adidas just gave him his own fire truck at his middle school in L.A. He is loving life.
He's good.
Right?
He's good. Well, I also think what it does is it underscores the challenge of what you have to do to contend every year if you're not a team with 3 or 4 or now 5 all-stars in Golden State, because teams like the Rockets and even teams like the Celtics the past few years have been thriving by finding guys who outperform cheap deals, and that's kind of what you have to do year after year. But it's not as easy as it looks to turn over like the back end of the roster annually and expect to find the right guys to replace everybody.
Very well said, and I know you're not going to want to give Golden State credit here because you hate doing that, but we should say, tip our hat, the Golden State culture stuff matters when you're able to retain guys like, you know, a Looney or some of these other players that they've been able to, you know, the role guys they've been able to keep on super cheap deals throughout, you know, the course of this 4-year tenure.
Yeah.
That's tough, and there's a reason why guys want to stick there. The David Wests of the world, right? Like, they view it as like a perfect basketball and life opportunity, and they're benefiting, you know, from, you know, all aspects of the Golden State Warriors experience, and they want to stick around. That is very, very difficult to replicate anywhere else. It's very rare. It's San Antonio-esque in some ways, and we're seeing the Spurs struggle to maintain it now, you know, after the Tim Duncan era. And I think for Houston, the hope was you were going to be able to create or at least mimic that same sort of magnetic type destination feeling. I mean, obviously it worked for a PJ Tucker. It worked for Mbamute in the first place. But keeping that going, sustaining it over multiple seasons, especially when the going gets tough and you drop a game 7 at home,
yeah,
that's a whole different type of challenge. And they're seeing it also with this Capella negotiation, which continues to drag too. And you know, I think, again, it kind of speaks to Golden State's unfairness and how they've sort of mastered some of these delicate chemistry things.
And the other thing that I would add on Golden State, and to be clear, Golden State deserves a ton of credit for a bunch of different things they've done over the last 4 or 5 years. But they did basically strike out on every like hit or miss decision on the back end of that roster. Just nothing went right for them this year. That's part of the reason the Rockets this past season was probably their best chance to beat that Warriors team, because like they basically, I mean, they took a flyer on Omri Caspi and that didn't work out, and the coaching staff was kind of iffy on him halfway through the year before they released him, and Nick Young was kind of a zero. They went 0-for-5 on useful big men, and like that's not going to happen again. So the gap is only getting wider between Golden State and everybody else, and it's got to be just brutal, because you know, like the Rockets' brain trust definitely realizes what's happening with all this. I'm surprised. You mentioned Capella. I don't understand why no one else around the league has just thrown a big offer sheet at him just to screw with Houston. Like, that's what the Kings should be doing. We actually got an email about that, but like from Adam. I don't understand why you wouldn't do that just to mess with the second best team in the league.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, you just wonder if the agents just don't take their calls, right? I mean, it's like, we don't care if you're offering max. Like, we don't even want to, like, mess with you. We don't want to have some weird scenario where Houston doesn't match and now we have to go play at Sacramento. No, I don't know. I mean, clearly, who would you rather give a four-year, $78 million offer right. to? Zach LaVine or Clint Capella? It's obvious. I mean, that's not even close. One of them is a proven two-way player with lots of postseason experience now, who's, gradually ramped up and been, among the most improved players here over these last couple of seasons.
And the
other Zach LaVine.
Capella was actually decent in the Warriors series. I thought that, like, the second half of that series, he was basically playing, like, 20 minutes a game. But when he was out there, he was effective. And if anything, I think Houston didn't use him enough.
Yeah, I mean, he was great throughout the playoffs, even before that series. And, it's nice to be able to play well against Golden State, but if you're Sacramento, just get a really good starting center. Try that. That'd be cool. I mean, you've drafted all these different centers. I mean, how's Papa Giannis doing? How'd that experiment go? Going through all these different guys. I mean, Clint Capella is so much better than anyone they've got on the roster, regardless of position. I mean, Clint Capella would go down there and be their best player, period.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that bad teams struggle with the most is it's almost like they remain pot committed to players who aren't going to work out, like Willie Cauley-Stein. Like, it's not the end of the world if you end up having to salary dump Willie Cauley-Stein to like Charlotte or something because you ended up with a above average. I mean, Capella's not an all-star, but he's like a very, very solid building block. And if they landed him and had to trade Cauley-Stein, that's like a net win. But I don't think that's how Sacramento sees it. I think they look at it and they're like, well, we've got 5 C-plus big men, so why change anything now? And like, I don't know, man. That's one way to play it.
Yeah. I mean, good luck getting inside their minds. That's a dark and twisted adventure.
Well, listen, let's move on to some more random questions about free agency, some odds and ends here. This is a very mid-July podcast. I'm enjoying it thus far. Kinley says, beyond all the Kawhi drama, Tony Parker has signed a deal with the Charlotte Hornets and the Big Three has become one. Does this move signal the end of the Spurs glory days and what happens to San Antonio from here? Ben, give me your live report from the monastery.
The Spurs glory days ended when our faithful leader, Tim Duncan, walked off the court and quietly and respectfully pointed to the crowd and called it a career. Ever since then, it's just been absolute chaos. The Parker thing, weird. I mean, I guess he's going to play more in Charlotte. It's easier, lifestyle out there in the Eastern Conference, but that's just really, really depressing. I mean, he pretty much wrapped up his career in the most depressing way possible rather than sticking it out with the one franchise or, just retiring. This second run, to me, it's going to be right up there with like the Hakeem Olajuwon Raptors days. I mean, it's in that same ballpark where it's like going to be painful on the eyes and the heart to watch this guy run around in a teal uniform.
I have to say, I am in complete agreement. When I heard he was going to Charlotte, I was like, okay, well, that makes sense. He's probably getting a balloon payment to basically like a golden parachute in Charlotte and to hang out with Nick Batum and Michael Jordan. I can get behind that. But then I saw the terms and he's only making like $5 million a year. And you got to figure Tony Parker has done pretty well for himself over the years and could just go back to France and be like royalty and help run their basketball programs for the next 30 or 40 years. And so like his quality of life is going to be quite high whenever he does actually retire. And I don't know if $5 million is enough to make make it worthwhile for him to wear teal for the next 2 years. I'm a little bit bummed out.
If you were him, would you have taken $5 million from Charlotte or a veteran minimum from Golden State?
Neither. If I were him, if I were him, I probably would take the $10 million, okay? It's real easy to sit here and be like, why would you do that? But
thank you very much.
But I don't think there's any scenario in which I would consider going to Golden State. I would maybe go to L.A. and play on a veterans minimum and just hang out in Hollywood for a couple years. That would make more sense to me. The one thing I will say about Tony Parker, though, is, and the Kawhi stuff has gotten so weird that it's almost too tortured to even try to dive into it real quick, but the note that was making the rounds back in late June when we weren't sure when Kawhi was going to get dealt was that the Tony Parker quote about his injury being 1,000 times worse than what Kawhi was dealing with is that quote kind of put Kawhi over the edge and broke the relationship for good. And some people on Twitter I saw were saying, I don't know whether Tony Parker really should have said that. He may have been a little bit out of line. And I want to say, I'm really glad that Tony Parker said that, because if Kawhi going AWOL is the move that ultimately kind of brings down this Spurs era, I'm glad that at least one person in the mix was able to call Kawhi a coward on the way out the door, because I think it needed to be said. They all clearly felt that way, and I'm glad Tony Parker just kind of like put it all on paper and put it all out there.
Yeah, and you know, there was also another round of buzz saying, oh, it was kind of taken out of context, or it came off harsher than he intended. You need to read his whole quote or watch the tape to understand what he meant. And Tony Parker kind of repeated that sentiment of like, oh, I wasn't trying to throw him under the bus multiple times, to the point where it was sort of like, I'm bringing this up again to pretend that I didn't do it.
Yeah.
But I just want you guys to know that, like, and by the way, Andrew, Kawhi still has not released that Instagram video I was asking for in May, where he just gives us a 10-second clip saying that he's all good. He's still disappeared. He deserves every last bit of the heat, and we should blame him for Tony Parker leaving the Spurs, even if it's not true.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. The Spurs, we can do another sort of retrospective when it really does come crashing down and when Pop leaves. But I think it's kind of been over for a while, so I wouldn't make too much out of the Tony Parker news.
Two things real quick, just sort of from the Lakers side of things, regarding Kawhi. The sentiment among some of the media people around the Lakers team, and maybe some fans as well who I've kind of talked to here in Vegas, is starting to lean really hard towards the keep all of the young guys, let them see who sticks and works with LeBron.
Yep.
Basically let Ingram, Lonzo, and Josh Hart. By the way, Josh Hart's been incredible in summer league. He's too good to be here.
You know,
he's in that.
I'm team Josh Hart through and through.
That's good. He doesn't miss. I mean, the backspin he gets on his three pointers are crazy. He's just been shooting lights out. They should shut him down. He's too good to be here in Las Vegas after two games. But you have all these young guys, so see who can work with LeBron. Don't sacrifice them in the Kawhi trade and try to sign Kawhi outright next summer. That's sort of been the building momentum on that front.
Yeah.
The other Lakers note, though, kind of in conjunction with that, I would say is some very deep-seated bitterness and frustration around the Paul George scenario and the fact that they couldn't even get a meeting. This really was sort of like the flirtation that went completely wrong. I mean, there was months of reports and rumors back when Paul George was in Indiana about how badly he wanted to play with the Lakers. And not to mention Magic gets, fined for tampering with him on national television. This was a long-standing pursuit. To have it culminate without a meeting, I'm not sure that we really stress that fact enough. There, that is very strange, very personal, and almost kind of bitter. And for Paul George to kind of wrap himself in the OKC flag, I think was kind of a smart thing. I mean, that party with Nas and Russell Westbrook was a good distraction from the fact that he really didn't even give LA any kind of a look.
Well, and it's bizarre. I mean, after the last 2 years of scheming to get there, the whole thing was just strange. And again, we talked about it a little bit last week. I think his agent played a role in all of this. And the one thing that I forgot is that not only does his agent, Aaron Mintz, represent Julius Randle, but he also represents D'Angelo Russell. So those are two star young players who were completely screwed by this Lakers regime. And that probably played a role in how much trust there was between Paul George's team and the Lakers. And I think it's a bad move for Paul George, and he probably should not have placed his future in the hands of his agent that way. But like, I mean, he seems happy, and that's just kind of the way business is done in the NBA. And that's what, I mean, like, the Lakers knew that agents were important, and that's why they paid Kentavious Caldwell-Pope last year and this year. So, like, I guess the problem for Paul George and the problem for Aaron Mintz is that Paul George was never, like, the number one priority in LA.
Yeah, I think you win some of those agent, you know, backslapping deals, and I guess you lose some of them, right?
Yeah.
The other thing I've heard about Paul George, you know, around in Vegas is, like, he almost belongs in that Dwight Howard or Kevin Durant category of superstar who can sort of be, like, steered or kind of, like, talked into things, and that, like, it winds up being the situation where, like, people are, like, really pressing him hard on the recruiting stuff, you know, trying to sort of make appeals to him because they feel like he can be convinced.
Yeah.
You know, that was always kind of like the knock on KD, is like, who's really deciding that he goes to Golden State? Was that his decision or the people around him? You know, with Dwight Howard, it was like, oh, he's so flaky, he's constantly changing his mind. One second he wants to go here, the next second he wants to go here. And I think both people who are in favor of Paul George's decision to go back to Oklahoma City and those who are confused by it, like you are, have both kind of told me, look, OKC got into his head a little bit. Like, they really put the full court press, made him feel special, you know, rolled out that red carpet treatment for him, threw him that party when he first showed up after the trade. And they think that really swayed him. Like, somehow it made him like Oklahoma City as a city and as a basketball destination, maybe even more than he should.
So it was sort of Stockholm syndrome with Russell Westbrook, which we kind of speculated about on the last podcast. That sounds like that's not too far off from what actually happened.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a slightly more negative way to portray what I just tried to say, like, very delicately, but yeah, sure.
Great. So, well, the other thing that you mentioned that I want to follow up on, because it's one of my favorite parts of Summer League, the idea of Josh Hart being too good for Summer League, that's kind of like the metric for success out there, where, like, the basketball is just so shitty all day long. And then when a guy has like 24 points, all of his fans turn around and say, oh, he's too good, we got to shut him down, save him for October. And I just love it. It happens every single year.
No, he's firmly in that category right now. There's no doubt. And he wants to keep playing, which I love. You know, I like when guys want to play, Andrew. Like, another guy in that category who I've had a lot of fun kind of mocking is Josh Jackson.
Yep.
Josh Jackson has played at a different speed here than a lot of the guys. You know, his ability to sort of just be everywhere at once, which I think is why some people wanted him drafted kind of coming out of college, and just being that athletic freak guy, that has really popped for Phoenix. I mean, he had one block shot where he was just skying, just swiped it out of the air, you know, basically like stood over the guy and glared at him. And he's had some of those sequences throughout this week where it's like, oh, okay, like, yeah, we have seen that progress. You know, the switch flipped halfway through his rookie season, and I think he's continuing to kind of develop and get more comfortable. And
yeah,
I like when players who are in that scenario say, you know what, I want to go play 5-on-5 basketball in the middle of the desert for no reason. I want to do that. I mean, instead of Markelle Fultz, who shows up, you know, head to toe in designer clothing, you know, and just watches from the sideline,
yeah,
and acts like a goofball in the background of interviews. Like, bro, you're ready to play. Go out there.
You know what?
You know,
I will say
you already
that.
Sat and watched during the playoffs.
Yes.
Get out here in Summer League and show me what you can do.
The Fultz takes, I don't know, it's kind of a toxic environment, and I don't want to speak with too much of authority in either direction in terms of like what Markelle Fultz should be doing. But what I would say...
Man up and say what your heart tells you, Andrew. This is going to be the 30 seconds of honesty. We're going to bring this new Andrew Sharp reports that we talked about last week where you just tell us the truth and you don't hedge. Here it comes right now. Tell us what Fultz should
all
do.
All right. Here's my take, okay? Look, it's fine to skip Summer League and it's fine for the Sixers to say that that's the best move for Markelle Fultz. But you can't skip Summer League and then still show up and be at every game and just be hanging out there the entire time. Like, either be tucked away in a Santa Monica gym with Drew Hanlon or go play in Vegas. But you can't try to have it both ways.
I really thought I was going to bait you into calling him weak in a win.
I'm still Team Markelle, okay? I just think he needs to be managed a little bit better.
All I'm saying is this, Andrew. After they strike out on LeBron, strike out on Paul George, it sure would have been great if Markelle Fultz had come out here, won Summer League MVP, cut up all these rookies who can't stay with him, show that he still has a jumper, poured in 25 points, and teamed with Furkan Korkmaz, or whatever that dude's name is, who scored 40 points somehow in Philly's first game, and really gave all the Sixers fans like reason to believe that the process was still ongoing.
So
that's what should have happened. Okay. Instead, we got him, you know, clowning and goofing behind the interview. Come on, man.
I'm
better than that.
I am mostly with you, and I'm with you on Josh Jackson in particular. I mean, the more I've seen of him, and even dating back to like the final month or two of the season, he does kind of feel like a 6'8 version of Marcus Smart, where he just is always around the ball and he's throwing his body all over the court. And then, like Marcus Smart, he'll have random nights where the jumper is falling and he becomes actually awesome. And I think that the fit with him and Booker could be as good as we expected it to be when Jackson was drafted a year ago. And I'm actually really excited to watch those guys together. And I also agree with you that, like, a second-year guy showing up and dominating Summer League is a good look, and I love it. Jaylen Brown did it a couple years ago, too, or maybe that was last summer. It's all blending together here. But the one thing I would add is another guy who did that was D'Angelo Russell, who showed up 2 years ago and like dominated his first game. He hit a game winner. He did that incredibly whack, I've got ice in my veins celebration, and then was immediately shut down, true to form, because it's Summer League, and things did not work out for the rest of his career from there. So we'll see. We're waiting on the D'Angelo revolution.
Yeah, we're gonna be waiting a while, but meanwhile, we should point out that since that happened with D'Angelo, the Lakers won last year's Summer League title, and they're undefeated so far in Las Vegas. They're 2-0 right now, trying to gun for a back-to-back. So, you know, you tell me, you know, addition by subtraction.
There you go.
It's worked out pretty well.
Not even a winning player in Summer League.
Hey, you know another second-year guy, though, who's close to your heart,
what?
Who I think we should maybe give a little love to? Jonathan Isaac, man, down in Orlando.
Hell,
we don't talk
yes.
about Orlando very much. And right on schedule, our only Magic listener, Kevin Diaz, came through with the email last night after you know, the combination of Mo Bamba and Jonathan Isaac really did a nice job in sort of frustrating and limiting Jaren Jackson Jr. I am captivated by Mo Bamba. Like, and you were making fun of me saying, you're not really going to watch Magic games. Like, you know, he's not really going to be a reason to tune in. Andrew, he's been a reason to watch. Like, the guy is just so long. But Isaac, second-year player, kind of, you know, not underwhelming, but under the radar rookie year.
Yep.
He plays with intelligence, activity, length, you know, solid positioning on defense where you can kind of see like, hey, best case scenario, this guy could be an all defensive level player. Like that could be in his future. Now, does he get into the right market and play on the right team and like get enough attention for it? You know, maybe not, but man, this guy is just around the ball a lot. He's really frustrating. He'd be a nightmare to have to play against. He doesn't do it in a, you know, a mean way. It's not like he's met a world peace out there. Like he's, you know, he's not that chippy. But it's a little bit of like the Michael Kidd Gilchrist factor.
Yep.
Where you know, he just goes and goes and goes and goes, and you know, he wears you down. You know, he takes advantage of your mistakes. He's very opportunistic. He's great at using his body, and unfortunately, you know, things kind of fall apart when he gets on offense. Like, he is, where am I going? Oh, I can't control my body. What shots am I taking? I don't know what I'm doing. But I think from Orlando's standpoint, when you're trying to find reasons to watch next year, like, I think year two, Jonathan Isaac's going to be a pretty intriguing guy to watch.
Yeah. Well, Kevin asked, has anyone been paying attention to Jonathan Isaac? And the answer is me. I'm always paying attention to Jonathan Isaac. I was super high on him in last year's draft. And I've heard great things from Vegas. You know, I like midway through the year, I think I came out and said, if we were redrafting this class, I would go Lauri Markkanen number one, Jason Tatum number two, Jonathan Isaac number three, which seemed crazy for a lot of different reasons. But I do think that Isaac projects to be really valuable and really versatile. And the offense is never going to be like dominant in a conventional sense, but I think he can be really effective on that end. The thing that I worry about with Orlando is that a lot of Jonathan Isaac's projected value in my eyes was as a like super versatile small ball five who could kind of do everything and just harass people that way. And putting him at the four, like, I don't know how effective he's going to be in that role if they're building the future around Mo Bamba. But look, Mo Bamba sounds awesome too, so maybe it's a good problem to have.
Yeah, I mean, no matter how many different moves they make, signing Biombo, trading Biombo, like, what do we do with Vucevic? I mean, all these different things, like, they still have a lot of positional issues there. They just paid Gordon, you know, his best position is probably four or five. You know, I would not be trying to play him at the three. You know, all their young guys, basically, you could make arguments and cases they should be fives. I guess I see Isaac a little bit more as a four because he's able to cover ground defensively, and you know, I think he kind of slots in there naturally.
Yeah.
But that's where Gordon should be too. So you know, you're kind of in this situation where you have a bunch of guys playing the same position, and still no point guard to kind of set them up or you know, get them going. So I think it's going to be frustrating at times watching the Magic. They're probably going to be in a lot of ugly, low scoring games next season. It's going to be a lot of growing pains as Bamba, you know, gets his body and his mind, you know, ready for the NBA level. I think it's going to be kind of a gradual rookie season for him. You're not going to be able to throw him out there and really expect big things in extended minutes. So that might help alleviate some of these issues, at least early on. But again, these guys do have a level of upside that the other prospects they've had in past seasons, like, you know, the Alfred Paytons of the world or the Hezonjas of the world, just never were able to deliver.
Keep Mario Hezonja's name out of your mouth. He's going to do great in New York next season.
What are you going to do about it, Andrew? Look, what's he going to do about it? I could talk about him all day
long. He's going to give you a very solid 16 points a game, real half-ass defense for a 30-win Knick team next year, clearing the way for Durant and Kyrie to show up next July.
Yeah, Jimmy Butler, that's the word on the street, is he's just so excited to go play with his own. Right? I mean,
well, look, I have one final question for you. Is Jonathan Isaac too good for Summer League at this point?
No, I wouldn't go that far. Like I said, like, offensively, he needs to really refine. I mean, you're saying you think he can be a productive contributor on that end. I'm definitely still waiting to see that because, like, stringing together three dribbles in a row for him, it's an adventure. You know, that's not a desirable outcome. Like, when he's running in the open court, it's more like, how is this going to go wrong than it is, like, how will it actually go right? And then I think shooting-wise, he's still not that smooth shooting type guy, not real comfortable. He's getting a little bit more aggressive in terms of taking his shot. I think the catch and shoot three-pointer is probably going to wind up being like a big part of his offense as he goes forward. I mean, he's not a guy who you really want to kind of force feed one-on-one, but the story with him, it's not the offense. It's the defensive impact, like I mentioned. And I think we're going to see that, you know, much more obviously, you know, this season. I think he's going to be one of those guys who winds up really shining in some of the impact stats and, you know, the real plus minus. I think he's going to be one of those guys this year.
Okay. Well, I hope he keeps working hard. He will get to that Josh Hart, John Collins level soon. But for now, Ben, let's wrap this up. You can go enjoy more highlights, historic moments at Thompson and Mac, and just live the dream out there.
That's what I do, Andrew, all day, every day. And I got to say, it's been a little, you know, a little sad not having you out here. I understand why you said you didn't want to come, but you've been you have a lot of fans. You have a lot of people who come up to me and say, God, can you believe he said they should trade Ben Simmons for Kawhi Leonard? I've gotten that multiple times. People want to rehash our LeBron argument, which has been really fun.
Great.
And it's been great to see the Open Floor Globe diehards out at Summer League day in, day out. It's been really humbling and, you know, just puts me in a good mood every time, you know, I meet people.
Can I add one thing? I think it may be time to officially rescind that Ben Simmons Kawhi take of mine, which I don't know if I was ever officially all in with that. I was more kind of throwing it out as a hypothetical, but I do think that Kawhi at this point, his situation is so sketchy that I would be wary of trading anything meaningful for him. I think that, like, if you're Philly, throw in Dario because you don't want to pay him big money anyways, maybe. Throw in Covington because I don't know how great he really is. But, like, giving anything more than that is probably not a great idea, which I'm sure a lot of people felt at the time. My only point, that was more about Ben Simmons than it is about Kawhi.
Oh, you were wrong at the time, Mitchell. We all knew. It's fine.
That's all right.
You can walk it back. Look, however you want to walk it back. We already know.
Just know that I am going to be on the right side of history with my Ben Simmons skepticism. I was briefly gaslighted into becoming a Ben Simmons believer for like 2 months at the end of the season, but I'm back out and I'm staying out for good. So thank you.
Yeah, didn't Michael Jordan like shout out the guy who made varsity over him when he was in high school during his Hall of Fame speech? You're going to be that guy for Simmons. When Simmons goes to Springfield, he's going to say, this Sports Illustrated writer, Andrew Sharp, came to training camp of my rookie year, threatened to fight me over whether or not I was a point guard. And look, I proved him wrong. I became the next Magic Johnson, LeBron James of the 21st
Dude,
century.
I was sitting
here.
There.
I am.
I was sitting, to be very clear, it's mid-July, no one's listening, we can talk about it. I was sitting there with Ben Simmons, and I was like, do you worry about the jumper at all? And he was like, you clearly never watched me in college. I scored 20 points a game at LSU. And I was like, well, not many of those were on jumpers. And then I was like, are you prepared for the challenge to be the point guard on this team? And then he compared himself to Kyrie Irving. And I was like, you're 6'10", and you can't hit a jump shot out of 14 feet. What the hell are you talking about? So it just, we had some creative differences in terms of what we envisioned for him. But we're both doing great, so it's all good.
No, I enjoyed your side of that story. I'm just telling you, I can't wait to hear his in Springfield. It's going to be fantastic. But Andrew, all of our listeners who aren't in Las Vegas, they can go ahead and send us emails to openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. They can also go to Apple Podcasts and hit us with that 5-star review. We love getting those. Everyone who is in Vegas, come say hi. It's great to put faces to names. It's great to talk hoops, and I will be here for, you know, roughly 6 more months until this tournament is over. So I got some time to kill. Andrew, until later this week, I will talk
to you. All right, man. Take it easy. Good luck out there.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.